Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ 100 hit record highs to close the week. He tells us what happened to Bitcoin after its first U.S. ETF was approved last week. Trends Journal publisher Gerald Celente says his crystal ball is a bit foggy when it comes to forecasting the stock market this year. He tells us why. He also believes lower interest rates later this year will drive the U.S. dollar down. But will America join Germany and China in recession? Veteran B.C. trader Victor Adair joins us from Vancouver Island. We'll look at the markets this year, bonds, gold, crude, and uranium. His website, victoradair.ca. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, the S&P 500, a little celebration there?
Yes, here we go. You know, it's been battering around doing nothing for a month or so, and then in the last 48 hours, what do you know? We've got all-time highs in the S&P, we've got all-time highs in the NASDAQ 100, and the big-name stocks are really driving this thing, the ones with the big capitalizations, the Microsofts, etc. And, you know, you've got NVIDIA now at just under $600. This has been, it was a darling for the first half of last year, and it's become the darling once again for the last 5 weeks. I mean, here we were under $500 10 days ago, and just shy of $600 as of today. So the big money is moving to the big names once again. But the one thing that is happening is that we're getting real diversification here. We've got a couple of Hindenburg sell signals here as of the last 48 hours. And that's when you've got more than just over 2% of the stocks on the NYSE making 52-week highs. And on the same time, you've got 2.5% making new lows. You got the McClellan oscillator generating a sell signal. And the 50-day moving average is in an uptrend, and markets in an uptrend. So when you've got all those pieces together, that type of diversification is such that you have to be wary of the market. Typically, when it runs out of steam, you'll end up seeing anywhere between a 5% decline and a 25% decline in the market. So you invariably don't have a crash without a Hindenburg. But Hindenburg doesn't mean that you will have a crash, but the probability is that you're going to have at least some kind of a correction. So momentum is on the upside right now, but one has to be very careful here, because once momentum is lost, there could be a little bit of a vacuum on the downside for now.
What's going on with gold?
The gold market has had a tough stretch here. We've been in the seasonally bullish period from November pushing forward. This one had that spike high, as we recall, way back in December, when it had that single day where it was up through 2150. And then the lower high about 4 weeks ago at 2080. So we're getting to the end of the seasonal play here. So I would think that There's an ability for, you know, gold, which is now at, what, 2030 as of the end of the week on the spot price. The 50-day moving average is providing support in here. That will need to hold, so that's going to be just around 2010. Any strength, I think one should be looking to exit out on the positions. And, you know, the miners have been hit pretty bad in here. I would suspect that there's going to be a decent bounce. I don't have a big oversold signal. I really would like to have had one of those to say that this is an interim low for the miners, but there isn't one in place as of yet. Hopefully, we'll find one in the, you know, in the coming months and really can be aggressive on the miners.
What's going on with crude?
The crude oil market, now this is the one that has held up exceptionally well during the last month or so. You know, it put in that that bottom back in December, retested it around $68 to $70 in January, and we're just boxed in right now at 73.5. The seasonals here are really good as you start to get into February and right through till April. So any close through the $74, $75 range, and I think you could see this thing on its way. It's been very resilient since the December low, and I think there's some decent potential. And just in the whole sector altogether, you know, we're getting to also the seasonally bullish period for gasoline, so you might want to take a look at being long gasoline as well.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Pretty quiet over here. The U.S. dollar index on this move, we had a good, what we call a sequential 9 buy signal on the weekly chart 4 weeks ago when the dollar was down at par 50, and pretty good rally up to 103.5. This is just sort of the classic for oversold and coming back to the 20-week moving average. And if we look back over the last couple of decades, that's, you know, what you would expect out of that bounce. So I think we could be ready for a little bit of a consolidation in here, maybe pulling back below 102. Have to see if the dollar is capable of pushing through 104. At this point, that's a pretty heavy resistance level, both in terms of overhead and where the moving averages are. So I think that, you know, the easy part of the play off the bottom is now behind us. And on the Canadian dollar, you know, we bottomed out at 74 this week. It's been a, you know, a market with a pretty good run from the November low at 72 up to just shy of 76. 50% correction at 74 was a reasonable spot for this to start holding in here. It wouldn't be too aggressive. There's no real trade here other than to think that we're in a trading range and we're in the middle of it now. So you've probably got 75-ish as a decent resistance, I would say.
There was a lot of excitement last week when an ETF for Bitcoin was finally approved in the U.S. What's been the fallout?
This was the classic. In terms of the action there, we had been targeting 48,555 as a level for the Bitcoin. If you take a look at the last 3 years here, from where the high was right down under to under 20,000, the Fibonacci retracement, the 0.618, was, as I say, at 48,555. And we've had big corrective rallies in Bitcoin, you know, all the way back since 2013. There's been six of them like this. Each one is a different magnitude in terms of the number, but in terms of the percentage, that Fib retracement has been very, very common. And in this case, for it to have then been sitting below that, sitting in that 45 to 46,000 range for a month and a half, and then doing that final push a week ago up to the target, just as the ETFs, this whole list of a dozen ETFs that became available, and the hype that was involved with it. I mean, this became a story that it was the classic. It moved from page 16 to page 1, and not only was it on page 1, it was above the fold on page 1. So this is the buy the rumor, sell the history. And at this point, the minimum downside move would look to be around 38,000. That would be a 38% correction of the rally off the bottom. And, I would thoroughly suspect that we're going down to test that and might be quite a bit lower. So at this point, there's a lot of overhead, no question about that. And the easiest move in the last week and a half has been to the downside, and I don't think that's over with.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Gerald Celente, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Gerald Celente, publisher of the Trends Journal, available online at trendsjournal.com. He's speaking to us from historic Kingston, New York. Gerald, Happy New Year and welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, thanks for having me. And as for a Happy New Year, it doesn't look so happy.
Your top trends of 2024 issue is out now. What's in it? How can people get it?
Go to trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com. And it's less than, it's $2.80 a week. And it's over 190 pages this week. And no ads. And we tell people what in the world is going on, what's next, and what they might want to do. And I'm not bragging, but there's no magazine in the world like it. So it's the only magazine that gives you in-depth socioeconomic, geopolitical, high-tech, AI, trends analysis and trend forecasts, and on, you know, health, fitness, nutrition. We cover the world. So we're doing everything we can to help the people prepare, and prosper in these times ahead, because it's a rough road. I'm at this is my 44th year, and I've never seen a situation like the one we're facing now.
Wow. Yeah, we'll dig deeper into it. But first of all, let's take a look at the stock markets this year. What's your outlook?
You know, it's a guessing game. Nobody can predict it because, number one, the game is rigged. And I say that because once upon a time, you know, I made my name, by the way, a part of it by among the forecast. I was one of the first to forecast the 1987 stock market crash, the dot-com bust in the Trends Journal. We said it would happen by the second quarter of 2000. We said that in 1999. I took out the domain name, the Panic of 08 in 2007. I thought the markets would crash again in 2012. They didn't teach me about zero interest rate policy and a thing called quantitative easing in Economics 101 or graduate school. They'll make up any crap they want to keep pumping these markets up, just like they did during the COVID war. Everything should have collapsed. Everything should have collapsed. No, we're going to pump in trillions of dollars. We have countless trillions around the world. Oh, and we're going to bring negative interest rates. We keep them over there in the EU. Zero interest rate policies in America, and on and on and on and on and on. So they're going to do anything they can to rig this market. And the reality is that it is controlled by the bigs. They own the entire deal. This isn't my numbers. They're 1%, according to Oxfam, 1% of the people own 43% of the global financial assets. Got it? That's who's running the show. All we are plantation workers of Slavelandia. 1% own 43% is disgusting. This isn't democracies. This is fascism, not my definition. A guy that I don't like so much is an Italian, Mussolini. The merger of state and corporate powers. Got it? That's what's in control. So they're going to do everything they can, the 1%, to not only own 43%, we want 53%. Again, not my numbers. The five richest men in the world doubled their wealth since 2020 when the COVID war was launched. Well, everybody else got poorer. So nobody can predict what's going to happen here. It's a crime syndicate that people call the markets.
Oxfam predicted we'll see the world's first trillionaire within a decade.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? And look at all the billions they're giving for peace. Oh, supporting all the, like, my Occupy Peace movement. Oh, we get billions from the billionaires. We don't get a penny. All they're interested in is the military-industrial complex and the gang that's running the show.
And with your zero interest rates, the ancient Greeks, Romans, Chinese, Egyptians never had negative interest rates. If it was such a good idea, why was it not done before?
Yeah, again, you know, it's people call the government, you know, it's a crime syndicate. They're murderers and thieves. By the deeds you shall know them. And I'm too big to fail. Hey, I'm Jamie Dimon. I'm too big to fail. I'm my J.P. Morgan Chase, convicted and admitted to five felonies. Hey, but I don't go to jail. Don't you know who I am? I'm a member of the gang. Yeah, here's a couple of bucks. Shut the hell up. Yeah, here's a payoff. Go on. Yeah, here's our fine. Oh, for rigging the precious metals markets? $900 million fine? Yeah, but it's nothing compared to the money we made. Again, and murderers. What's your favorite war?
Gold is still trading in a range around $2,000 an ounce. What could cause gold to break out of this trading range?
Well, the Middle East war is ramping up. And by the way, that was one of our top trends of 2023, Middle East meltdown. We said this would happen. Netanyahu just said on Thursday that we will target Iran. Oh, yeah? Great. You have every right to target Iran. I mean, after all, you're killing people in Syria, Lebanon, Gaza. You sure target Iran. They're admitting it. Iran gets dragged into this war. You're going to see oil prices spike to $130 plus a barrel, Brent crude, and then you're going to see gold skyrocket. Number two, they're going to lower interest rates this year in the run-up to the presidential reality show in the United States, because the clown we got as our Treasury Secretary's last job, Janet Yellen, was running the Federal Reserve. So everybody with a brain bigger than a pea, see who's running the country. The banksters. They want to keep the bankster gang and the one right in charge stay in charge. They're running the Treasury. They're the Secretary of the Treasury, the former Fed head. So they're going to lower interest rates. The lower interest rates go, the deeper the dollar dives. This is the beginning of the death of the dollar. The only reason gold prices are not skyrocketing is because the dollar is still strong. When interest rates go down, the dollar goes down, gold goes up. Plus, again, all the geopolitical tensions, it's the number one safe haven asset.
We keep hearing about the pending U.S. dollar collapse, yet the U.S. dollar continues to be one of the strongest currencies. But all the other currencies have to collapse first, then drag the dollar down with them?
Not necessarily. The dollar, again, the dollar's only strong because of the high interest rates. You're looking at a $34 trillion debt. Now, look at the cover of this week's Trends Journal. America drowning in debt. Yep. And the nation's sinking. You know, it's over. It's over. Who could have this kind of debt and keep going? Again, in the Trends Journal, we have all the details of how much it's costing each month to service the debt. How much it's costing each year. They can't do it. There's no way in the world they're going to pay this off. No way.
Could we see higher inflation and higher interest rates ahead?
I don't see higher interest rates ahead, but we see higher inflation. And again, a study just came out. One of the major reasons inflation is still high is because the corporations are keeping the prices high, although a lot of the commodity prices have gone down. So they're going to do everything they can to keep making money. Again, the 1% controls the world. And all you have to do is look at the Davos gang to see what's going on right in front of everybody's eyes. So inflation, again, if Middle East war keeps heating up, you're going to see inflation skyrocket. Because one of the things bringing down inflation are the low energy prices. We would not have thought that Brent crude would be selling at around $78 a barrel. But it's also oil prices are down because manufacturing around the world is down. Demand is down. Look at your PMI numbers. You look at the manufacturing index. You see them down all over the world. Oh, yeah, consumers are buying more. But they're making less product. And then when you put the consumer numbers in, oh, yeah, they're buying more. Yeah, not when you put inflation into it. It's basically flat. And again, Europe is in a recession. Germany's in a recession. Japan's heading into recession. It's one after another. China, you know, they're barely staying up. They got a 5.2 GDP rise, but they have a crisis in front of their hands. About 25% of the GDP is related to the real estate market, and that's collapsing in front of everybody's eyes. Again, China brought it on themselves with their COVID war and their 3 years of zero COVID policy.
What do you think the real rate of inflation is, taking into account the prices of energy, food, housing, and so on?
Well, you go to Shadow Stats, John Williams Shadow Stats, and you know he doubles it. You know, it's more than double from what they're saying. Again, the cost of prices of a home going up. Now, we're not going to add that into inflation. We'll put the general rentals and everything else, and we'll make up any kind of crap we want. They started rigging the numbers in the 1980s and 1990s to not reflect the real inflation numbers. So you can't afford to buy steak anymore, and you're eating ground beef. Well, that's fine. We just changed our diet, and we changed our expenses, so we're not going to put that in as an inflation cost. So the whole thing is rigged.
Is credit constriction a better indicator for the economy than interest rates?
They're both very important, and they both play the game. You have to look at both of them and analyze them, and they're only elements of a much bigger picture.
Year after year, we hear about the debt bubble. Could the debt bubble continue to grow for years to come?
No, and that's what we're saying. The death of the dollar is happening. The only reason the dollar is strong is because the other economies are so weak and the interest rates are high. When interest rates go down, the dollar's going to go down. So it's the beginning of the end of it. And again, the whole globe is going down. What do you think you have all this migrant crisis for? People escaping their countries, lack of basic living standards, government corruption, crime, and violence. This is just the beginning.
How long after housing markets peak are we likely to see a waterfall drop in home prices?
We don't see it really, really declining as much as it did during the panic of 08. Because back then, you don't have a job, you're deep in debt, don't worry about it. Sign over here. It's called the subprime mortgage. They didn't do that this time. People bought the homes with money. It's gonna bring down the prices as we start seeing more and more unemployment numbers rising, and they're going up. I mean, it's day after day. Macy's just fired 2,300. You know, Google just fired 1,000. One after another, day after day. So those people aren't going to be able to afford to keep their homes. So that's going to soften the prices. But again, when interest rates go down, that's also going to drive up the real estate market to a bit. But we see prices going down, but we don't see a crash this time. The crash is going to come. It's already happening, but we're the only ones who've been reporting on it for the last 3 years, and that's the office building bust. You have your office occupancy rate in the United States at around 50%, according to Castle Systems. Your office vacancy rate, nobody in them, around 20%, according to Moody's. 20% vacant. I'm the guy that owns the buildings, or the gang that owns the buildings. How are we going to pay our loans? You're not. Oh, your loans are only interest. You only got these loans that are interest loans. So now the loan is due. You need a whole new loan, and so it's revolving loans, and interest rates are way up. Interest rates are way up because you got less tenants and less money coming in. This is the beginning of the banking bust. You're going to see the banks go bust this year, levels we've never seen before. And that's the kind of thing that's going to crash the markets when people realize how bad it really is. And it's the entire commercial real estate sector.
We're hearing experimental medical procedures are killing millions. The numbers of dead higher than wars, could we already be in World War III?
World War III's already begun. We said it from COVID war to Ukraine war to World War back in the cover of our Trends Journal on February 22nd, 2022, 2 days before the Ukraine war began. And now you have the, and again, our top trend for 2023 was Middle East meltdown, and now that's expanding. And so we're already in World War III. It will only become, quote, official when there's a major event that happens, whether it's a false flag or real. And again, they teach us the crap like we're in kindergarten. World War I began when they assassinated the Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. What the hell is an Archduke and who's a Sarajevo? You know what? What are you kidding me? This thing was ramping up long before that. Oh, no, World War II began in the United States when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Oh, you mean not when Franklin Roosevelt seized all Japanese assets in July of 1941 and the United States, UK, and the Dutch cut off three-quarters of the Japanese export trade and 88% of their oil, the only import 100%. You mean that didn't start World War? No. It only began with bombing of Pearl Harbor. You know, so what I'm saying, it's already begun. There's going to be a false flag event. And the other thing, too, Ukraine's lost. We said they weren't going to win from the beginning. I mean, you got to be an idiot to think that they're going to defeat the Russians when Napoleon couldn't left Poland with 420,000 troops, came back with 10,000. Hitler, Operation Barbarossa, killed over 25 million Russians. They were the first ones to defeat the Germans. So you're going to see Ukraine do something very dramatic, bombs away. In Moscow, we're already hearing they're bombing St. Petersburg, maybe a nuclear power plant. They're going to get back in the news. World War III has begun. When all else fails, they take you to war. The global economy's failing. What followed the Great Depression, World War II? What followed the dot-com bust? The War on Terror. And now you're going to see World War III. But don't worry about it, because they asked Albert Einstein what kind of weapons will be used to fight the Third World War. Cat that knew a thing or two about the atomic bomb. He said, I don't know, but they'll be using sticks and stones to fight the fourth.
Where are there safe places to keep money and wealth, and are banks one of them?
No, I wouldn't keep them. I only keep money in the bank that pay for our business. We try to keep as little in there as possible. Because, again, Charlie, we have to take a break. We just heard that the Russians hacked into our banking system. They're going to make something up. And again, the banking bust is going to come, and they'll do anything they can. They're going to come out with a digital currency too, by the way, and they're going to use an excuse like that, you know, the Russians did this or something, and because they want to know every penny we spent, where we spent it, what we spent it on, so the politicians can roll the dough and steal as much as they can from us. So going back to the banking, once upon a time, there was another arrogant guy who gave us World War II, Franklin Roosevelt. Turn in your gold. You don't turn in your gold, you go to jail. Sell it for $26 an ounce, and after we get it, we're going to raise the price. What, it's like $32 an ounce, $36 or something? No, it's a crime syndicate that the people call the government. They'll steal any dumb money you can. And why would you trust the banking system when you can see who the banksters are? Oh, once upon a time, there was someone by the name of Jesus Christ that became violent and built a whip to drive the money changers out of the temple. Nothing's changed. Same money changer gang.
Massive migrant influx into Western countries. Is this beneficial to economies and society?
No, it's detrimental. And again, they're letting it happen because go into any... Again, all things are connected in trend forecasting. The bigs took over everything. I just gave you the numbers of the 1% owning 43% of global financial assets. When I was a young man, there were no Lowe's, there were no Home Depot, there were no Walmarts, there were no Staples, there were no CVS's. They were all locally owned. Grocery stores, drug stores, stationery stores, hardware stores. The bigs own everything. So go into any one of the bigs, and you'll see a sign when you're walking in, help wanted. Because all we do is we pay the plantation workers of Slavelandia just enough money to eat, maybe find a place to live, and then get back here and work. They have no future. Every time I go into like a Home Depot to buy stuff, my heart breaks when I see the people working there because I know they have a lousy life and no future. So they need help. So they need more cheap labor. So they're going to keep letting the migrants come in so they can keep getting more and more cheap labor. They did that with the H-1B visas I wrote about in my book, Trends 2000, international bestseller. When the Internet revolution began, they needed cheap labor, and so the H-1B visas, bring them in from India, you know, on and on and on. They did it during the Vietnam War era. I'm 77 years old. They're drafting everybody. All right, we're going to change the draft laws. Migrant laws. When I was a kid, I remember my parents, they couldn't get their cousin Constantino coming in from Napoli into the United States. The restrictions were so tight. And then they needed more cheap labor when they were drafting all the guys during the Vietnam War, so that's when they began to relax the immigration laws. So it's all about power, money, and cheap labor. It's all they want is cheap labor. Again, all we are plantation workers of Slavelandia. End of story.
Yes, in Canada, the Restaurant Association wants the immigration rules eased so they can import more cheap labor.
Yep.
And yet, Canada has a housing crisis. We're short millions of houses. Where are we going to put these people?
Don't worry, they'll steal your money to put them in, build something and put them where they'll just keep robbing your money in the name of anything. So just make sure you give them all your tax dollars so the scum politicians who've been sucking off the public tit all their lives can keep sucking off the public tit and steal your money to do what they want with it.
What are you seeing ahead for the presidential reality show and voter fraud extravaganza?
It's a guessing game. Anything can happen between now and November. I began my career running political campaigns in Westchester County, the richest county in America, back in 1971. I designed and instructed a course called American Politics and Campaign Technology, how to run political campaigns, and I taught it at St. John's University. I was the assistant to the Secretary of the New York State Senate. I know this game, and this game got a long way to keep playing out. But remember, when all else fails, they take you to war. And when you go to war, people forget about everything. Again, the people were so ignorant, stupid, arrogant. Look at the clown boy you got up there in Trudeau. Look at the little jerk we had over here, little Georgie Bush, little daddy's boy born on third base, thought he had a home run. We're going to get that guy Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Over 88% of the people swallowed his crap. Oh, that was happening right. After the dot-com bust, when America was in recession and people couldn't stand him, and his popularity rating skyrocketed. Got it?
It's an election year. Are we likely to go through another plandemic with lockdowns and other craziness?
No. They won't do that. But again, it's going to be war. That's what we see. No, they won't do that because they want to get votes. So they're not going to try to do anything negative in that realm. Negative on the big end, of course. You know, once upon a time, there was a thing called the Declaration of Independence. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty? You have no liberty. You do what I tell you to do. Happiness? Never mentioned. Never, ever mentioned. Misery is all we sell.
Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum meeting up in Davos, Switzerland this week. Are politicians with allegiances to the World Economic Forum over their own country committing a crime?
You mean Klaus Schwab? Look at that freak. How can anybody believe that? Look at him. Look at him. How can you look at that evil-looking piece of scum? And you know what their number one threat, their words, not mine, disinformation and misinformation. That's right. Persistent false information, deliberate or otherwise, widely spread through media networks, shifting public opinion in a significant way towards, you ready? Distrust. In facts and authority. Authority? This is their number one thing. Ranks number first. Authority? You mean a bunch of arrogant little clowns are authorities? Stand 6 feet apart. The wind blows exactly in straight lines in 6 feet. Wear your mask, even though you read the box and it says it doesn't do anything for you. When you get on an airplane, you better put that mask on. But when you can sit down and eat and drink, you could take it off even though you're sitting around everybody in a small airplane because COVID knows that you're eating and drinking and it ain't going to bother you. This is the authority. Misinformation and disinformation means only swallow our crap. We're in charge. And again, That's their language that I just read to you about persistent false information. And that's their number one, misinformation and disinformation. Number one is a new leader of the top 10 rankings this year. That's a quote from Davos.
Could China's wealth get wiped out in an economic downturn?
Absolutely. You know, you look at China's GDP before they were brought into the World Trade Organization by Bill Clinton. They officially became in 2 weeks after 9/11. Nobody paying attention to it. The GDP was a flat line, just going up a little bit from 1970. They get into the World Trade Organization, 2001, poof, straight line up. And with every boom, it's overbuilt, overspeculated. So it was going to contract anyway. But then they launched the COVID war on Chinese Lunar New Year, January 2020, the year of the rat, and 3 years of zero COVID policy that destroyed the lives and livelihoods of hundreds of millions. So they made a very, very, very bad situation extremely worse. And again, when all else fails, they take you to war. You're going to see China take over Taiwan either this year or very soon. And again, none of my business has been going on. All the international, Taiwan is not a free country. It's part of China. And it's none of my business what China does, but everybody, all those dirty Chinese, they'll become involved in it and escalate more war. So that's where we see China going. It's going down, no question about it. You look at their numbers, imports, exports, everything down.
And there's 2 million fewer Chinese.
Yeah, but that's nothing when you got 1.4 billion people. And again, you look at the world, you go back 100 years ago, around a little over 100 years ago, like 1917, you had 2 billion people on the planet. And now we got 8 billion. China got 1.4 billion people on the planet. I mean, in their country. They don't need more people. They lose 100 million, it'll make no difference. So they keep ramping that up like that. The globe is way overpopulated. And look at the problems we're having with the migrants. Too many people, not enough jobs, not enough income.
Over the past few years, some people think we thought were intelligent turned out to be sheep. Do you have hope for humanity going forward?
It depends on the irate, tireless minority. And that's Samuel Adams, the founding fathers of America, does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority, keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men. And the masses don't know anything. You know, they have their own lives. They're not reading. They hear little sound bites of junk, and they respond, you know, to it.
Gerald, how can people sign up for your Trends Journal?
Simply by going to trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com. It's the only magazine in the world where you will read history before it happens. Again, what's going on in the world, all of it, everything's been forecast. It's there for, you know, do we get it right all the time? Of course not. You know, we're human beings. And that's why when people call me a futurist, because I have best-selling books, Trends 2000, Trend Tracking, far better than Megatrends, Time Magazine, publishing the Trends Journal since 1991. Nobody could predict the future. There are too many wild cards, be they made by humans or nature. And we're in a wild card game right now, like the likes of which I've never seen in my 44 years of trend forecasting. So we're urging people to really get, you know, you better know what's going on and prepare, prevail to prosper, because this is going to be the most dangerous times in our lifetime as we're moving forward, unless we have peace.
Gerald, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Gerald Celente, publisher of the Trends Journal online at trendsjournal.com. He was speaking to us from historic Kingston, New York. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclical, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF. and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in British Columbia, but still very active in the markets. He's speaking to us from Parksville, which is a beautiful spot on Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Before we discuss individual markets, what's your big picture view as we start the new year?
Well, there's a that's a wide open canvas. I tell you what, let's say in November and December, we had a terrific rally in the stock market, the bond market. Gold prices went up. The U.S. dollar was weaker. Foreign currencies were higher. And, you know, I think even commodities got a bid. But what we had during that period of time was the market had decided, okay, that the Fed was finally going to stop raising rates and was going to start cutting rates. And as I've written in my blog on and off for the past year or so, you know, when the market really thinks that way, they see it as a green light special to buy stocks. Well, I'll tell you, the rally was astonishing, way more than I would have thought. But my point is that the most important thing in the financial markets during the last 2 months of last year was the market's anticipation of what the Federal Reserve was going to do. That was more important than any other variable, like the expansion of the price earnings ratios or you know, guesstimates of what kind of earnings were going to be. All that stuff was like in the shadows compared to what the market thought the Fed was going to do. So we get into 2024. And the first couple of weeks, I think there was a general sense around like, hey, you know, we maybe took this a little bit too far too fast. I was certainly writing that in my blog. And we had rates back up a little bit. The stock market kind of got a little choppy. The weaker end of the stock market, like the Russell 2000, like the part that's well away from big cap tech, it was actually off pretty good the first couple of weeks of this year. The U.S. dollar turned higher. Gold prices struggled. So, you know, and the bond market, I should say, also, you know, was weaker. But just being focused on the stock market, we kind of had that opening here that, okay, the market had gone too far, too fast in November and December. We kind of went sideways. And then here, like this week, it just became incredible to the upside. And to say that artificial intelligence, you know, and let's call it NVIDIA, has just led this rally like it's unbelievable. I think NVIDIA is up about 20% so far this year. That would be a market cap of about $250 billion. I think the market cap now, and it's moving so fast it's hard to, you know, put a pin on it, but I think we're at about $1.5 trillion market cap on NVIDIA. All of the stocks that have, like, anything to do with artificial intelligence have been bid sharply higher here. The whole Magnificent Seven is higher, except, and maybe we'll get to this later, Tesla, and that's going to be interesting when we talk about energy. Another thing that's happening is, you know, the market was expecting the Fed to cut rates because, you know, inflation had come down. Well, it's interesting with consumers. Now, 70-some percent of the American economy is consumer-driven, so this is big. Consumers seem to have, I mean, when you look at the sentiment surveys, just this past week, it looks as though consumer sentiment is very strong, okay, that people have been getting wage increases. They think inflation has come down and will continue to come down. Jobs are plentiful. I mean, unemployment's at, you know, multi-decade lows here. So another aspect of, I think, the support for a stronger stock market is consumer spending. It's probably going to stay strong. That helps companies generate earnings and so on and so on and so on. So in terms of big picture stuff, I guess, you know, that's kind of what I'm seeing. And from one other thing occurs to me here right now before we finish this, and that is that money managers, people who are running other people's money, you know, aside from maybe some specialty funds here and there, just cannot afford to not be in this market, racing to the upside as it is. You know, we have had the NASDAQ, the S&P, as well as now the Dow earlier, have gone to new all-time highs. So people have to be invested. If you're running other people's money, if you're not, you know, the other people are going to take the money away from you. And we've seen, I guess, around the turn of the year, that passive mutual funds and ETFs are now bigger than actively managed funds. So passive, they just buy the market. The theory behind passive is don't try to time the market, don't try to pick stocks, don't have a short-term time frame, just put your money in the stock market, you know, and when you get older, you're going to be well rewarded from having done that. So those folks that are managing the passive money are putting their money into the market on a weighted kind of a basis. So that just, I think, exacerbates the gains that we're seeing in the strong stocks and makes the ones that are left behind look even worse. So, yeah, that's a bit of a ramble, Jimmy, but that's kind of where I think we're at, you know, where we've come from the last couple of months and, you know, going into the next part of the year.
The bond market had its biggest two-month rally in years in November and December. It's been sideways to lower since then. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, the bond market, I think we had almost like 3 years in a row down by when we were at the lows that it hit in the end of October. My thought was, I guess, maybe the bond market had just got so deeply oversold that it was going to get a bounce. And so when the market started to think, okay, the Fed is going to cut rates, I think that started to, you know, light a fire under the bond market. Now, I mean, interest rates were the highest they'd been in years. I think 16-year highs on the 10-year, the yield. So the bond market had this tremendous rally, probably the best 2 months I think we've had in decades. Okay, that's November and December. We got into this year, and just like the market in the stock market started to rethink, maybe we'd gone too far too fast in terms of assuming, you know, the Fed's going to be cutting aggressively. The bond market's been struggling here, actually has been going lower early in, well, from the end last week, say, of December into where we are now. My thought on the bond market has been throughout all of this that the real driver here is going to be the supply of bonds. I think Western governments in particular have no interest in balancing the budget, to call it that. So we're going to see more deficit financing. And what that means, you know, they just borrow more money. And as the cost of paying back borrowed money goes up and the amount of money that you borrowed has gone, you know, is increased, I think there's just going to be pressure, like people can say, who wants to buy bonds? First of all, maybe when the stock market's doing so good, who wants to be in bonds? But I think we're going to see the bond market struggle to get yields down without a recession. And I right in through here, I think that the folks that did think a recession was coming, even they've given up on that. So it's the supply due to fiscal policy that I think will be a weight on the bond market. We want to get political for a minute. We got an election coming up in the United States. You'd think the administration's going to try to do what they can to, you know, make the economy look as good as possible before the election. If Trump is elected, you know, some people will say one of the first things he'd do would be to fire Powell. Well, I'm not sure that that would happen, but you know, he talks a very expansionary fiscal policy. So I think there's a reason here why bonds have been going down as we've gone into 2024 and the stock market's been going up, whereas, you know, in November and December they were marching lockstep together. Anyway, that's kind of my thought on the bond market. I'm going to be watching it. I haven't got a position on at the moment. I'm afraid I kind of missed getting short. I wanted to do that, but you know, as a trader sometimes you miss things and you just got to let it go.
The U.S. dollar fell in November and December as nearly all foreign currencies rallied. What's next for the greenback?
Well, I tell you what, you know, if I really, really, really knew the answer to that, right, blah, 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 I could retire for. I've said on your show many times that capital comes to America for safety and opportunity. And those two words are different, but sometimes they have a similar draw. You know, safety, when the rest of the world looks like a troubled place, America looks like a safe place to put your money. But right now, I mean, the USA has got a tech industry, you know, that is head and shoulders above everybody else. Now, you could point to Taiwan and say, you know, they've got the chips and all that. But really, for people that want to invest in, say, the sharp end of the computer market, there's nowhere to go outside of the United States or nowhere that anywhere near that. So I think that'll draw capital to the United States. I've generally been bullish on the U.S. dollar. A lot of sophisticated analysts have had the other side of that. You know, they've been bearish on the U.S. dollar for any number of reasons. But, if I have to flip a coin, which I don't, you know, I'm more likely to be bullish on the U.S. dollar than the other way around. Now, one of the exceptions to that might be the Japanese yen. The Japanese yen now is down about 50% from where it was in 2012 when Abe started a program. He called it his Three Arrows program to try to get the Japanese economy up and going again. The Japanese stock market, some people have viewed it as being, you know, the best bargain in the world. It's been on a tear to the upside. Not as hot, I don't think, really, as the American market, but there's that. At some point here, the Japanese yen may turn and go higher. It's at 30-odd year lows here. A lot of people have lost a lot of money trying to pick a bottom in, say, the Japanese bond market or the Japanese yen. But that would be one currency that might rally against the U.S. dollar. But generally speaking, I'm going to be inclined to be a buyer of a U.S. dollar against everything else, especially, I'm going to say, that the Eurozone. I think Europe is struggling relative to the USA. Now, if they had a wonderful piece of news, like, you know, the Ukraine war ends and Europe is able to focus more on, you know, making stuff rather than dealing with the war on their eastern frontier, maybe that puts a bid into the euro for sure. I don't know. But anyway, I sound a little bit undecided. I don't have a position on right now, but that's kind of always my bias. I like the U.S. dollar.
Will the Canadian dollar trade in line with the euro or the U.S. dollar going forward?
You know, the Canadian dollar usually, here, say it this way. If all the other currencies in the world or the main currencies in the world are trading higher against the U.S. dollar, the Canadian dollar is probably trading higher as well. When I watch my screens closely, and as I have for nearly 50 years, you know, I can see that the Canadian dollar will have a correlation that way with other currencies. But I also see the Canadian dollar correlated to the, call it the S&P 500. I'll just watch that correlation. And then, you know, on a bigger picture environment, the Canadian dollar will move with commodities. I've looked at the euro Canadian spread, and I've seen the euro is increased against the Canadian dollar from, say, 18 months ago or so. I think there would be some aspect of the rest of the world, when I say capital comes to America for safety and opportunity, some of that money will come to Canada, just because, so Canada can have a tie to the U.S. that way. I'd be inclined to think that Canada would, this will also depend on where commodities go. I think commodities catch a bid, you know, then I would say Canada's going to look more like the U.S. dollar than tracking the euro.
Over the past couple of years, you've often said that rising interest rates and a strong U.S. dollar create a toxic environment for gold. Do you see gold falling from here?
I think gold could struggle. I have shorted gold. At the end of the year, I was short of gold. And let's review a little history. The gold market in the beginning of October was near to making new lows for the year. Then the Hamas attack on Israel put a strong bid into the gold market. So gold rallied. And then as we got into the general rally in November and December, gold was also bid higher. And gold was bid higher as the U.S. dollar was weakening, as interest rates were falling, sort of the opposite then of a toxic environment. So gold will get a bid on geopolitical events. For instance, when Russia invaded Ukraine, gold got bid higher quickly. So not surprising that the gold market got a bid as the fear, I guess, of a widening conflict in the Middle East was front and center. But the big bid, I guess, in gold people that trade gold would know this, but it is the central bank buying. And when I say central bank buying, by far and away, that means the central bank of China and Russia bought a lot of gold last year relative to their historic performance or whatever. Central banks in total, the buying the last couple of years since essentially Russia invaded Ukraine. And the fear got to be known that if you were an enemy of the United States or a perceived enemy of the United States might grab your assets. So, you know, instead of owning U.S. Treasury bonds, maybe you want to own gold bullion. And that's really gross to say it that way, but that was kind of the essence of why the central banks were in the market. I'm just looking and thinking both the conflicts in Ukraine and Israel may be closer to a negotiation phase than, let's call it mainstream media might have you believe. And I think if we were to have a dampening down of geopolitical stress, that would be a drag on gold. I generally think U.S. dollar is going to do better. And as I just mentioned about bonds, I think interest rates are going to go higher. So I'd be, from those kind of fundamental reasons, I'd be looking at being short gold rather than long. And, of course, when you're short gold, you're always taking the risk that something unexpected happens, you know, as you are with any position in the market. But if there was another spike in geopolitical crisis, you know, you'd be on the wrong side of that if you're short gold.
In the energy markets, we've seen a powerful rally in uranium while crude has gone sideways. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, the uranium rally has been tremendous. It has been a few things. On the one hand, it's been a supply shortage. I mean, you put things in perspective. After Fukushima happened in 2011, I think there's been more nuclear generation facilities closed than started, but I don't know that. So pretend I didn't say that. But certainly, the demand for uranium went down. Japan closed a number of their facilities. Germany just closed the last of theirs, so they get in the fall. And, you know, uranium was in a toxic environment, let's call it that. And we've had a tremendous run. Now, one of the proxies, I guess, I use are just shares of Cameco, a Western producer instead of being, you know, in some like Kazakhstan. The share prices are up 10x from where they were at the lows in 2020. They're double about what they were a year ago. Let's say we're around $45, $50 a share in Cameco. Those are the highs we had way back in 2007 or so. And I think shares are trading around $45 before Fukushima. So prices had fallen a lot. Down to $5 a share, say on Cameco, and have rallied up to $50 a share. So there was an interesting couple of news events this week. Well, let's say this. When you have a market that runs like that, you know, and everybody is just jumping in or can't believe how much it's been going up. There will be some folks that just say, gee whiz, you know, I got to take profits here. This has just had a hell of a run. So the two news events. Ford announced that they're going to build less electric pickup trucks going forward. It's called the F-150 Lightning. They sold 24,000 of them in 2023 compared to, for instance, 750,000 Ford F-150s with internal combustion engines. So I'm thinking that the prospects of sales of electric vehicles have maybe been reassessed here. You know, maybe it's not going to be just a, you know, a shot to the moon in terms of the number of these electric vehicles being produced. Another story is that the price of a used Tesla has fallen about in half from where it was, say, 18 months ago. I'm just doing this by memory, Jimmy, so, you know, people listening, forgive me if I'm wrong by a little bit, but that's the picture. And why is that? Well, I think, you know, the love affair, say, with, oh, gee, wouldn't it be cool to have an electric car, and then you find these stories about how much it costs if the battery goes haywire and you got to, you know, fix that. I saw Hertz, for instance, had bought a bunch of Teslas for their rental fleet, and now they're blowing them out because they found that it just costs an arm and a leg to fix them when something goes wrong. So anyway, I'm just saying maybe this week, after this tremendous run that we've had to the upside in the uranium story, we had a couple of bits of news that maybe changed people's idea as to how much how many electric cars were going to be produced. So whatever. I'm definitely not bearish on uranium. I mean, you look at the big picture story on it in terms of supply-demand, it looks like a real winner. But that was just something I noticed this week. I've seen so many markets race to the upside like that, and then something happens, and they have a significant correction. Whether or not we get any more to the downside, and crude oil, you were saying, yeah, it hasn't done anything. Crude really seems to have been struggling just above, let's call it $70, $75. I think part of that is very much is a supply-demand story. You know, production around the world is increasing. Certainly demand is as well, but you look at some of the forecasts, and it doesn't look like we're going to be, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel to get oil to meet demand. So I think that's the difference there. Crude oil looks like maybe a fairly matched market going forward, whereas uranium looks like, you know, demand is going to be way greater than supply.
In the weekly trading desk notes on victoradair.ca, you recently wrote you're more interested in market sentiment and positioning than forecasts. Why is that? And how can our listeners benefit from looking at positioning in the markets they trade?
Yeah, I have been, I guess, for a long time. I mean, my good friend Martin Murenbeel, the international gold analyst, and Martin and I have been close friends for years and years and years, 30 years. And he says, Victor, you like to call bullshit. And I remember I just left it. Yeah, I guess that's me. I'm Mr. Contrarian. And
that's where the referee throws the brown flag, right?
Something like that. But that's kind of been my nature, you know. I just sort of want to be the other side of the trade when the market gets what I would describe as goofy. You know, when people are falling all over themselves to buy something, you know, and there's been some goofy stuff out there in the market. I mean, there's always been. I mean, if you remember back in 1999, for instance, some know-nothing company would just change their name to knownothing.com, you know, and the share price would double. So there's always goofy things going on in the market. Anyway, one of the ways of looking at positioning, and I write about this in my blog, is using what we call the commitment of traders data. In the futures markets, which are pretty much the only markets that I trade, we keep track of who's buying what, if you're, you know, big enough to be noticed. Now, they don't publish the names of people, but we just break it into groups. And I became aware of the COT data and tried to use it going back 30 years ago, but I struggled with it, and the struggle, honestly, was because my time frame was too short. And let me just say it this way. the thought that I had back in those days, and this still has some merit, is the COT data would break the participants into what we would call commercials and then speculators, just to make it real simple. So the idea was that the commercials, whether they're producers or users of that commodity, probably knew more about that market, you know, than speculators who would kind of, you know, go from one market to the other, whatever looked hot, they'd chase that and so on. So you'd want to look at an opportunity where the commercials were heavily bet one way and the speculators were heavily bet the other way. And the thing is, the market could stay in that condition for weeks or months, so timing was a real problem. I read about a fellow called Jason Shapiro in a book called The Unknown Market Wizards, written by Jack Swagger. And I think a lot of our listeners will know who Jack Swagger is because he wrote the Market Wizards books. Anyway, Jason, I found him, and to make it short, he has a service. He calls it the Crowded Markets Report, where he does a great job. And I've been looking for somebody like this for years, somebody that does a great job of really breaking down the COT data so you can use it. And he's made a really wonderful distinction, and that is, he says, you know, don't fade price. A lot of people will look at a chart and say, this has gone up too far, too fast, I'm going to short it. Dumb idea. And by the way, I've done that a lot. What you want to do is say, the market's gone up a whole lot, and the speculators are long, the commercials are short, and then you wait for a sign that the speculators might be way out over their skis. Now, the sign classically would be some news comes along that is bullish news. The market jumps a little bit but closes lower on the day. You say, okay, there's a technical signal. Now I can fade this market, and I got a natural place where to put my stop. Jason, and certainly I'm like this, before I get into a market, I want to know where I'm going to get out if I'm wrong. And if the market's made a high and now it's broken down, you say, okay, if it makes a new high, I'm wrong. So now you got a real spot to put your stop in the event that the market's not working out. So, you know, there's forecasts, and, you know, they're a dime a dozen, right? You look, particularly around the end of a year, everybody and his dog is putting out a forecast as to what he thinks is going to happen in the year ahead. I definitely read them, because that helps me get a sense of what the sentiment is in the market. But when I read reports, I'm not looking for somebody to tell me buy this, sell that. What I'm looking to do is to get an idea about a market that I might not have had if I hadn't read the report. Okay, so and by the way, you know, I'm not disparaging the economists or the analysts. I mean, there's some incredibly bright guys who've had some incredibly great calls. It's just that forecasts are that. I like to find the sentiment is also one thing, but when people actually bet their money, and now I think they're vulnerable to being wrong and they're going to have to unwind their trade, you know, that's when I want to be there on the other side of the market when they are trying to get out of what they got into. So anyway, I do write about that, and if people look at my website, they can go back and look at different reports that I've written, actually going back 7 years, and that's largely courtesy of House Street Radio. You guys have archived a lot of my old reports, but you know, you can go back and see more about positioning in prior reports.
Victor, you're going to be making a short trip from Vancouver Island to Vancouver at the start of next month. Why is that?
The World Outlook Conference. Mike Campbell has been a good friend of mine for about three decades. We've had the World Outlook Conference. This will be the 36th annual. I'll be the lead-off speaker at the conference. It's going to be on Friday, the 2nd of February, and then most of the day on Saturday, the 3rd. It'll be at the Bayshore Hotel in downtown Vancouver. If you Google Money Talks, that would probably be a good way to start, and you'll find your way to getting information about the conference. Or, yeah, now that I think about it, it's also on my website. If you went to victoradair.ca and opened any one of the the last half a dozen or so weekly reports. Scroll down that report, you'd find links and information about that conference. So I'll be speaking there. Joseph Schachter, who I know you talk to from regularly, he will also be speaking there. There's going to be some great speakers. We usually get about 1,000 people at the conference, and then maybe another couple of thousand people that watch it on the videos that'll be released a couple of days later. Anyway, that's why I be there, and I look forward to it. It's fun to see. I listen to all the speakers myself, not just go there to do my speech.
Victor, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, Jim, you know, I get wound up. It's fun. Thank you very much for having me on your show. I always enjoy doing this.
My guest has been Victor Adair, his website, victoradair.ca. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Gerald Celente, and Victor Adair. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for our guests or for the show, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.